docket today, and that is Puckett against Hummaker. Council, when you are able to do so, you may set up a council table and proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Renee Ozer, registration number 16997 for Joseph Puckett. And what Mr. Puckett is requesting the court to do in this case is basically extend the notice prejudice rule to yet another clause of a basic insurance policy. In this case, the newly acquired vehicle provision, which provides automatic coverage. And the notice prejudice rule has, beginning in 1979, but basically in 1989 with Hansen versus Barmore, Colorado and most other jurisdictions has moved from a technical, very rigid enforcement of policy provisions on notice to one that is more results-oriented. And in Hansen versus Barmore, it talks about substantial justification for providing notice wherever it came from that gives the insurance company substantively what it needs to know. But there's either an adequate excuse for the notice not being technically compliant, or when the purpose of the provision is met by actual notice, whether or not in strict policy compliance. And in the auto insurance realm, you had Clementi in 2001 that extended it to underinsured motorist coverage, and then you had Friedland in 2005, which expressly overruled Maris, which was a 1981 case, applied to liability coverages. And both of those cases emphasized the protection of tort victims, which is certainly a concern in this case. Mr. Puckett was initially not expected to live. He had severe brain injuries, and he has severe residuals. And stepping back, the policy says you, meaning the named insured, must provide notice that the new vehicle has been acquired. Well, I don't think any reasonable consumer, when they acquire a new vehicle for a 16-year-old, is going to think, you know, I better pull up in my policy and look and see exactly who has to make this notification. In fact, what they're going to do is buy the car and call the agent and say, we've bought a new vehicle for my daughter. And in this day and age, when you have divorced parents, a lot of what you get is this division of labor where the parent that buys the car turns over the paperwork to the other parent, including the notification. And that's what you have here. You know, under strict compliance with the farmer's notification policy, what you'd have in a regular family is dad buys the car, and not mom, but the stepmother, who's married to the named insured, has to make that notification. And that is probably not going to happen, and it certainly defeats the purpose of having vehicles, all the vehicles on the roads, insured and protecting tort victims.
Council, Ms. Ozer, we have here something a little different, isn't it? We have here a car that's purchased by father for the daughter, and mother calls and gets an insurance policy on it.
Mother called and said to the, remember, these are all farmers insureds, and said to her agent, we need insurance. And she says very specifically in her deposition, I left it up to him. And in fact, in her deposition, she didn't understand she had $25,000 coverage. She thought she had $100,000. And even if that were true, I mean, or well, it was true, you had the policy made out to, who would suspect that you could call and get a policy on a car in which you had no insurable interest at all, which is exactly the situation of Deborah Hammaker and Gilbert Espinoza. You know, neither of them had any insurable interest at all. And
they didn't need it. They called as the agent of their daughter and secured an insurance policy, which was written and provided on the car.
But how would that affect Lonnie's independent rights as the policyholder? I mean, if you, for instance, had your secretary call and say, you know, arrange coverage for my daughter Petunia, and somehow, and if you look at this deposition, it really was kind of a who's on first conversation, that your daughter's got a $25,000 policy issued to your secretary. Now, certainly she was your agent, but why would that affect your rights as the co-owner or the owner of that vehicle? I mean, in fact, your daughter would have two policies at that point. There's no election provision in this policy, which sets it apart from Beck and Bramlett and the other cases that, you know, from Kansas and Colorado that really covered this issue, you know, until now.
Counsel, let me clarify this. And by the way, thank you for illustrating in your hypothetical the daughter by the name of Petunia. That's going to be as I understand this insurance policy here, the car was automatically covered for up to 30 days.
Correct.
Is that correct? I mean, so that on the, if an accident occurred on the 15th day, notice on the 30th day would have absolutely covered that automobile. So far, so good?
Yes, although our position is notice was provided.
Here, am I correct that the accident occurs outside the 30-day automatic window?
Yes.
So it seems to me that the apparent purpose of the notice provision at that point is the insured basically notifying the insurer that we have a new car, we need to insure it, we want you to add it to the policy, and we expect to be charged for it.
Correct.
Okay. So in the absence of notice by Lonnie or someone acting on Lonnie's behalf, why would the insurance company think to charge more premiums and add this car to Lonnie's policy?
Because as Buddy Brazil said, his impression was that Lonnie was the owner of the car. Now, if that wasn't going to work, then the insurance agent should have said, you know, you either have to retitle the car or Lonnie has to call and tell me. You know, other courts have addressed, because that's a common response, is that, well, I didn't get charged for this. But Colorado has said, and I think Christensen said, you don't have to provide it for free, but if you don't bill, you can't then use that later to decline coverage. And that's our position, is that the notice was given. Substantively, they had the VIN number, they had, you know, Buddy Brazil thought Lonnie owned the car in toto, and in fact it was Lonnie and Amanda on the title. And that was enough to trigger this. If you use the notice prejudice rule, that is enough to, because the other condition, which is that all of your cars are insured through Farmers, was undeniably met. And as I see, I've got 10 more, or 5 more minutes?
6 minutes and 6 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll talk another minute.
Well, let me just, I guess, just want to say, it seems to me that what you're asking us to do essentially is to wrest the notice prejudice rule from the context in which it has been applied and apply it to this new situation.
I think that the notice prejudice rule is going there, that, you know, you started out with the UM-UIM. Friedland really took it after, you know, Mr. Friedland had defended his case and you know, was going back to Travelers for, you know, for help with his defense costs years and years later. But I think the notice prejudice rule conceptually needs to apply to the entire insurance policy. I mean, if you're talking about protecting tort victims and protecting consumers, you don't have, well, you have a notice prejudice rule here, but over here, you don't. And in this case, they do have some grounds to rely on their agent to tell them, look, we need to talk to the policyholder. You know, we can't, we shouldn't be writing a policy for somebody who has no insurable interest in the vehicle. I mean, that's how the credit default swap mess happened. And, you know, you either need to retitle it, which, you know, I wouldn't be here, or you need to put it on Lonnie's policy, or you need to take out a new, you know, policy and title it to Amanda. And that didn't happen here. The mother went in and said, we need insurance on this vehicle. And, you know, the agent took the policy that was on another vehicle and transferred it to the new vehicle and wrote a new policy for the other vehicle that had been insured under the other policy. There was a lot of sleight of hand. And under the strict provisions of the automatic coverage provision, there's notice provided, and if you interpret that under the notice prejudice rule, you've done your notice, and all of those vehicles, you know, every vehicle in these two families was insured by Farmers. So I'd urge that, you know, you clarify for the rest of us that notice prejudice rule applies to the entire policy. And I'd like to reserve my time.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, Lori Moore, and I'm appearing on behalf of Farmers, the appellee. Briefly, I would start out by saying that this is a very simple contract case. The parties to the contract in question are Lonnie Hammaker and Farmers Insurance Exchange. A fundamental principle of contract interpretation is that you construe the contract to affect the intent of the parties. The intent of Lonnie Hammaker and Farmers with respect to this policy was that if Lonnie Hammaker purchased another vehicle, he had 30 days within which to notify Farmers of that, and they would add that vehicle to the policy. If he did not notify them within 30 days, the policy would not be changed to include the newly acquired vehicle. The further intent of Lonnie Hammaker and Deborah Hammaker in this case was that Lonnie Hammaker would purchase the vehicle for his daughter and that Deborah Hammaker would secure insurance for the vehicle. That Lonnie Hammaker never intended to add this vehicle to his policy. Deborah Hammaker did exactly what was the agreement between her and her ex-husband. She contacted Mr. Brazell and said, Mr. Brazell, Amanda's father has purchased this vehicle for her. I would like to add her to my policy. And she had a number of policies, and there was some readjustment of the policies. But what happened is Mr. Brazell added the vehicle to Deborah Hammaker's policy. Deborah Hammaker was charged a premium for that policy, and there was, in fact, coverage on this vehicle at the time of the accident. The plaintiff is arguing that the telephone call by Deborah Hammaker to Mr. Brazell somehow created notice on the part of Farmers that there would be coverage under Lonnie Hammaker's policy. It is quite simply illogical to conclude that a stranger to the contract could affect the actual terms of the contract. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Counsel, let me stop you there, though.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask, you did mom have an insurable interest in the car, and does it matter?
I don't think that mom had an insurable interest in the car. I don't think it matters. As Justice Graham indicated, Deborah Hammaker was contacting Buddy Brazil on behalf of her daughter who was a minor who did have an insurable interest. And whether there's an insurable interest is not the question in this case. In point of fact, the vehicle was insured under Deborah Hammaker's policy. There was coverage. It was paid out for this loss. Sorry, did you have another question?
Well, yes. I appreciate your reliance on the contract principles, but I think we have to acknowledge that the notice prejudice rule is something that applies to forgive or overlook failures to comply with policy language. Is that correct?
Yeah, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that there is a huge difference between the notice prejudice rule that has been adopted in this jurisdiction as well as other jurisdictions. Under the notice prejudice rule, there is a contract of insurance, there is coverage. There's no question about the contract and what it entails. The notice prejudice rule simply states that, one, we understand there's coverage, and yes, one of the parties didn't technically comply with how they were supposed to give notice or when they were supposed to give notice. But in fact, adequate notice was given, and there's no prejudice to the insurer. And there is two public policy reasons that underlie the notice prejudice rule. One is we want to make sure that there is coverage for vehicles out on the road and coverage for tort victims. The second reason is that we don't want to have a windfall to the insurance company who has accepted premiums over time and then comes along and says, well, you notified us on day 31 instead of day 30, so you don't have to pay anything.
Of course.
Neither of those public policy provisions apply to what would essentially be rewriting this contract to provide coverage where the parties never intended that there would be coverage. So I see a very distinct difference. And I would urge this court not to extend the notice prejudice with respect to claims to creating an entirely new contract, which is essentially what's being asked for here.
Well, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm curious on your view on just this point, and this may be an academic point. Lonnie's policy, he paid premiums, and among the things that he gets for his premiums is an automatic 30 days on this car. What if the accident had occurred within 30 days and the notice comes in, say, from Deborah or from somebody else or afterwards? Doesn't this seem like a direct or a very similar context then in which the insurance company is not prejudiced because this car actually is covered under Lonnie's policy for at least the 30 days?
You know, I've actually given that a fair amount of thought, and I would respond as follows. I think that the insurance policy provides for a grace period, if you will, of 30 days. If I go purchase a vehicle, I have 30 days, like Mr. Hammaker did, to notify the insurance company. If there's an accident involving an owned vehicle during that period of time, I would agree with you, there's coverage. In this case, if the accident had occurred between the date of purchase on August 7th, 2003, and the date that other insurance was acquired by Ms. Hammaker, I think it's August 27th or August 28th, I think there's coverage for the vehicle under those circumstances. If the accident occurred after August 28th of 2003 and before the 30 days had run, I think that's a new question for the court based on the Bramlett decision out of Kansas and the Beck decision out of Colorado.
Thank you. It seems to me that there's a battle of contracts here. From the insurance company's perspective, recognizing that there's automatic coverage on husband's policy on a newly acquired automobile, it seems to me that it's taken away when another household calls and says, we want a policy. And from the insurance company's perspective, it gives policy, covers that automobile. How can that automobile continue to be a newly acquired car for purposes of the automatic coverage under the husband's policy?
I don't think that it can be, and that's exactly what Beck is saying and what Bramlett is saying, is that once that vehicle has coverage on it somewhere else, by definition, it is no longer a newly acquired vehicle, and automatic coverage is not triggered. Did I answer your question? I think I understood it.
Yes. Thank you.
So, again, farmers would urge this court not to extend the notice prejudice rule to actually reform the contract in this case. Something that wasn't pointed out, I don't think, by either counsel in their briefing, and I would like to address it, is that many of the cases that are cited involve multiple policies within one household, which is a very different situation than what we have here. And in many of the cases, one example would be, I think it's the Satterfield decision out of West Virginia in 2005 that was cited by the appellant. There's a question as to whether or not there are ambiguities between the two policies in the household. So as you review the decisions and formulate your opinions, I would just ask you to be cognizant of the fact that most of the cases cited involve policies within one household, and that changes the dynamic of interpretation between the policies. Another thing that neither of us, I think, pointed out very well, and that is in a number of the cases that were cited, the accident actually occurs within the 30-day time frame, and again, that's not the situation we have here. One last comment I would like to make, and that is that under the exclusion of paragraph 10 in the farmer's policy, if Mr. Hammaker owns a policy, it's available for the regular use of he or a family member, and he hasn't obtained coverage on it, there is no coverage under the policy. And I would reiterate to the court that I think that exclusion applies here as well, to deny coverage for this loss. And with that, I will conclude my remarks unless any of you have any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Ms. Ozer?
Again, I would point out that in the policy structure, in Lonnie's policy, he had coverage for newly acquired vehicle. That is worked into the premium. It is not a freebie that is given, you know, 30 days freebie. This was something that is worked into the policy structure. And as many of these cases point out, if you don't want to provide the automatic coverage, if there's another policy, then you need to put an election provision in your policy. You need to say that you've got automatic coverage, but only if there is not another policy, a collectible policy from the named insured. I think that's the language in Dolan, where you had the father and the son who both had insurable interests, and the court said, you know, both of these policies apply. There's coverage under for each of these owners independently. And as far as the time frame goes, it's a much easier case if you had this accident happen within 30 days of the acquisition of Lonnie's truck. I don't think we'd be here. But if you look at Carey, the gap was 2 months. If you look at Christensen, the gap was 3 months. From the time that the vehicle had been acquired to the time of the accident. So the harder cases do talk about after you're beyond that 30-day automatic coverage, because they point out, what's the use of the automatic coverage if you've got 30 days to give this notice, you're in an accident at day 15, the insurance company says, sorry, you didn't give notice. That's not automatic coverage. And I have a real problem when I listen to the language in Beck and Bramlett, which, by the way, they didn't need because there was an election provision in that policy, where they said a newly acquired vehicle is no longer newly acquired when you write an insurance policy on it. Now, that's nowhere as a special definition in the policy. And I think that totally would confound a consumer that their brand-new PT Cruiser that they got an insurance policy on, oh, that's no longer a newly acquired vehicle. They would say to you, in terms of just basic consumer parlance, what do you mean? This is my brand-new car. I've had it for 3 months. You know, there's not a scratch on it.
Of course, the question here is interpreting a contract and the phrase newly acquired car. It's not whether it's a new car or not, or
truly
whether it was newly acquired to the consumer. The question is whether it comes within a matter of coverage under the newly acquired clause.
If there were something in the policy that defined it that way, but there isn't. And policy construction, if there's not a special definition, you know, you go with what people on the street are thinking. And my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Ozer. Thank you, Ms. Moore, for your arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our document.